I'm Sue Birmingham. I'm president of the Manchester branch of the Geography Association, and this is the first lecture of the year. And you can probably see it says it's the H.J. Fleur Memorial Lecture. So we remember the first professor of geography from Manchester University, Herbert Fleur. He was quite a famous person of his time, first Victoria Medal for geography. Once you start researching him, you just find out it's fascinating some of the really early geographers, which we're now reaping all the benefits because we're now over 100 years later studying geography. But I'm going to go quickly into today's lecture. Today's lecture, we've got a real treat. We've got Danny Dorling, who's come all the way up from Oxford today. I assume it was today he came up. Yes. And I've just quickly asked him, run through, how did his geography journey start? So when he was 18, he was choosing which university to go to. He left home, which was in Oxford, and he went to Newcastle University and did geography and maths at the time. And he was there for 10 years studying geography. And then afterwards, he went to Bristol. So you can do a quick map in your head. So he went down to Bristol for 3 years as a lecturer of geography. Then he came back up to Leeds for 4 years teaching geography. Then he went to Sheffield and was there for 10 years teaching geography. Then a little time in New Zealand, and he has ended a mile from where he first was born and was growing up in Oxford. So he's returned to Oxford and he's got a really interesting title. He's the Halford Mackinder Geographer, Professor of Geography. And that title is, we remember, the first person to have that post as a geography lecturer. And he got half his funding, I think, from the RGS at the time. So when geography started as a real baby subject. So we've got a real top-notch person going through lots and lots of aspects of geography tonight, and with a lot of maps as well. So I'm going to pass straight over to Danny. So thank you very much. Thank you. And if I just change over from document camera, and hopefully that has worked.
Nope.
I'll go to the PC. Yes, thank you very
brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you ever so much for the invite. It's great to be back up in Manchester. The lesson of the introduction is be very careful. You may never get out of doing geography. I did try and I did fail, and it's, I'm afraid I'm going to be in it for the rest of my life. I'm going to stop talking in 35 minutes at 6 o'clock, so we've got about a quarter of an hour for questions. And so don't worry, you're going to be leaving on time. I've only got I've got 12 slides, so it's kind of seven maps, but it isn't too many. And I'm going to start very locally, and I'm going to end up with the universe, is the way we're going to do it, but the universe slide isn't that exciting, let's warn you. And this is all about thinking about change, thinking about the world you're living in, looking at it in different ways, and questioning how it is. The maps I'm going to show you, only a few of them were produced or could have been produced when I was at school. Most of them are maps that never existed. This is 30-odd years ago. So the way in which we draw maps changes. The way in which we draw maps in 20 or 30 years' time will be very different to now. So it's not just that the world is changing, the way we look at the world is changing, and the way we understand things is changing. This first map, it's actually going to be two, map one. This is a little town in which I was born. But what the map shows you, the map is a series of maps from 1750 onwards, the map shows you how the town changed. And the reason I decided to put this up was to tell you how lucky you are. Because how many of you live in Manchester itself, in the city, the district? Put your hands up higher. Okay, how many of you live in Greater Manchester? And how many of you live out of Greater Manchester? Okay, so I've got some idea. That's it, isn't it? That's our whole universe we've got. Now, you've got things like the Peak District. And I didn't realise how valuable the Peak District was until I went back down south and discovered that we don't have it in Oxfordshire. What we have in Oxfordshire, it's not just that it's flat. There's lots of exciting things in Oxfordshire. There are 2,000 lakes in the county. It's just that you can't go to any of them because they're all privately owned. There is no right to roam. There is no national park. I live in a little city, which in effect is walled. And these maps show the kind of story of that city. 1750, really just a set of monasteries in the middle and a quarry and some farming villages. That particular picture was taken from Ellesfield Village, just north of Oxford. That's not a picture, it's a portrait, didn't have cameras in 1800. It's very hard to get those views of Oxford because it's so flat, but that's an idea of what the place looked like in 1800. It begins to change by 1830, and the reason it began to change is that the university lecturers could stop pretending that they were not having sex. Okay? Until 1830, their dad pretended they were chaste. They were priests, and they didn't do anything naughty. Of course they did, but they had to pretend they didn't. And then the rules changed, and they were allowed to get married, and they were allowed to have a family, and they're allowed to have children. And if you look at the 1830 map, you'll see some orange appearing just north of the centre. And that's the houses they built for themselves and their wife and their children, but also for their servants, because they were used to having servants. They didn't actually know how to make their own beds and so on. By 1900, you can see it's growing even faster, but it's mainly university growth. It's growth from out of the centre where the university is. However, by 1939, we were getting industrialisation. Very late compared to Manchester. You got the first. This is the first, it's been called the first American city. It's the first grid city, the first industrial city on the planet. You had all this a lot earlier. In Oxford, we didn't get it until the 1930s. And you can see some expansion down to the south east of the city. The university and the colleges didn't like that. They didn't like a car factory coming to Oxford. They didn't like other industries. They wanted it for themselves. But there wasn't much that they could do about it. And you can see the expansion to 1939. But there was one thing they could do about it. After the war, we got a green belt. And the green belt was imposed, and colleges bought fields just outside the green belt. Now, you can't see it in 1939. But if you look through to the 1970s, you can see all the growth that there was up to 1970, all the orange areas, the new build. And I was a child in the 1970s. I left to go as far away from home as I could because I didn't want to be near my mum and dad because that was normal. And I went away for 30 years. And then I come back about 5 years ago. And if you look at the 2001, 2011 and 2021 pictures, you can see there's no orange. Because they stopped building. And the reason they stopped building is that there wasn't any land that they were allowed to build on because we had a really tight green belt. In some cases, it's only a mile from the centre of the city. Controlled by the colleges that own the land because they didn't like the idea that this city was going to expand and be a mixed industrial city. It's a tiny city between London and Birmingham. The biggest city between London and Birmingham, but still absolutely tiny. Why am I moaning about it? Because our house prices are 17 times our average salaries. It's a city that in many ways no longer functions and doesn't work. But the interesting thing about change is that at the moment, on the edge of that city, in what is the green belt around the edge, colleges are selling off the land as fast as they can, right now. And the reason that they're selling the land off, well, one of the reasons, or the only reason I can think about why they're doing it, is because Her Majesty's opposition have said that if they've come to power, they will buy the land, compulsory purchase it, at agricultural prices, which is almost nothing, for the building of housing. And so the Green Belt is about to be breached. But sadly, the Green Belt is currently going to be breached by developers trying to build large houses with two or three garages for people who might work in London. Right, series of maps, one story about one city. Last night in the town hall in Oxford, the planning permission went through finally for the first new secondary school since the 1950s. That new secondary school will be built directly in the line of that portrait from the village. Loads of arguments about it. What nobody in my hometown seems to realise, we need more schools desperately. What nobody seems to realise is, if you build that school there, you're going to get housing in future all the way back up to those trees, which is going to be interesting. One map. Second part of that first map, and let me carry on boating. This is the last of Oxford, so don't worry, we're going to get off this. But I just want to tell you, local stories are fascinating. If I was more confident, I'd be showing you a map of here. And the map I'd show you of here is Engels' map in Conditions of the Working Class, which is one of the most interesting books ever written in the English language. And it shows you areas directly around where we are now. But I'm not that confident to talk about places I don't know. These are cartograms. These are stretched maps. Who has not seen a cartogram before? Put your hand up if you haven't seen these. Go on, brave. I'm not going to make anybody speak. I might lie. Okay. Who has seen a cartogram? Who's too shy to put their hand up? Well done. Okay. So, what happens here? You take the areas and you stretch them to make them proportional to something else. In this case, they're made proportional to jobs and people. And what you can see there is that there are far more jobs in Oxford, much higher proportion of jobs in the city than there are people. We'd need about 75,000 more people in the city if we were to have enough people for the jobs. So what happens is that on a peak day, 40,000 people drive across the Greenbelt, belching out carbon dioxide from their cars, to park on the edge of the city to work and do the jobs that are needed in the city. I'm just trying to show you one way of looking at that, or one way of talking about it. So we have a green belt which is not very green. It's a green belt that generates enormous amounts of pollution. What could we do about it? As you've probably guessed from what I've been saying, I don't really want these developers to build these large attached houses with two or three garages for people who work in London, which nobody in Oxford will be able to afford. If you want a city to look at, look at Freiburg in Germany. And look at what a future, increasingly car-free, bicycle powered, walking, public transport, tram city looks like. And the kind of arguments that are happening now over developing places like Oxford is, do you just let the free market reign, in which case the people with the most money get to do what they want, or do you plan for the future, which we don't do? And if you plan for the future, if you're going to build, you'd be building very near the city, and you'd be building places with no car parking at all. Map number two. You've missed a boring bit about Oxford, you're fine. Map number two. The most exciting map in human geography for at least the last 30 years. I've drawn more maps of this country than anybody else. Very sad. Nothing to be proud of. I've drawn thousands and thousands of maps of the human geography of Britain. After a time, they all begin to look similar to each other. A map of who does well at school looks the same as a map of who dies early, looks the same as a map of where the house prices are low or high. Draw the map, you get another map, you go, oh yeah, there's the same pattern. Look, isn't Macclesfield posh now? That kind of thing. This map came along. This was the referendum on the 23rd of June 2016. Who got to vote in the referendum on the 23rd of June? Ooh! There are quite a lot of people who are not at school for that, I assume. Okay. I won't ask you how you voted. Oh, interesting one. Who could have voted and didn't bother? Oh, you liars. Yeah. It's definitely 50% of the 18 to 24-year-olds. Not their fault. Your vote hadn't mattered before if you're that young. But anyway. So there's the map. Let's forget about Scotland. Scotland had a different kind of agenda going on. The yellow in Scotland is Scotland voted to remain. Majority in Northern Ireland voted to remain, although it's a really interesting pattern in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, they knew about this thing called the border, which we're discovering about in England. We hadn't realised we'd signed an agreement on Good Friday. That means if you put a yoghurt pot on that border, you're in trouble. So amazing what the English don't know about borders. And there's the map. Manchester, majority remain. Liverpool, majority remain. But mainly London, majority remain. The map with the shades of colour shows you how strong the vote is. The Remain votes were stacked up very, very high in Remain areas. But in most of the country, you have a Leave majority. Although it's quite hard to see it here, the majority of Leave votes were actually in the south of England, south of the Severn to Wash line. And the reason the majority were in the south of England is the majority of the population in the south of England. The turnout vote rate was higher. People are more likely to vote in the south. But also, lots of people are very annoyed in the south of England about their lives. I've just moaned to you about Oxford, but Oxford was a very solidly happy Remain area, something like 75% Remain, because that's people who can live in Oxford. Those 40,000 people have to drive over to Greenbelt every day to do a job which is often not a particularly well-rewarded job, hence why they have to drive over to Greenbelt. They're much more likely to be annoyed, and they're much more likely to have voted a couple of years ago for anything but this. This is a remarkable map. I'm going to zoom in to a couple of areas to kind of show you how this map isn't understood. The typical way in which this map is talked about is that people talk about Middlesbrough and Stoke and Sunderland, because Sunderland came out first, and Merthyr Tydfil and places like that. Poorer northern Welsh areas having voted. It's a completely wrong story. Completely deceptive story. And we're still looking at the numbers, and the numbers are very simple. We know how many people voted to remain in each area, how many people voted to leave, how many people were not allowed to vote, and we know in each area at least how many people chose not to vote. So some complicated maps to... three complicated maps, and then we get easy again to try to give you an idea of this. People don't often talk about Hampshire as being Leave Central. Hampshire's a fairly affluent county down on the south coast of England. The north of Hampshire is commuter towns to London. The south is the University of Southampton and so on. In Hampshire, 54% of people who voted, voted Leave. And there were a lot of people in Hampshire. Remember, in the country as a whole, it's 52. In Hampshire, it's 54. That's 546,267 people, to be exact, in Hampshire voted Leave. And what I've done here is I've picked a set of areas in the north and in Wales, which actually have an electorate slightly bigger than Hampshire, so more people who could have voted, and I've looked at their vote. And I call it anti-Hampshire. And anti-Hampshire is made up of the whole of Leeds, the whole of Blackpool, whole of Sheffield, Sheffield's fifth largest city in Britain, Merthyr Tydfil, Derby, and Great Yarmouth. Right? Areas that are typically talked about as places that left. And they're all areas that voting majority Leave. And if you add up all those areas, which have a bigger electorate than Hampshire, you actually find that a lower proportion of people voted to Leave, only just 53.7, but much lower absolute numbers, 494,000. Hampshire was much more important than all those areas put together. So you've got to think, and I won't try and guess at it, if you want to ask questions in 20 minutes' time when I stop waffling on, you've got to think, why doesn't anybody tell you that it was Hampshire that was more important? What is it about the way in which we report the news, in which we analyse elections? I'm going to slowly work my way through the home counties, but the good news for you is I've only got one more, which is Essex. But I'm going to do Oxfordshire, I'm going to do Surrey and so on in future. Essex, 62% of people voted to leave in Essex. 622,000 Leave votes. And here's the beginning of anti-Essex. Anti-Essex is very big. To get a set of areas in the north with an electorate, again, slightly bigger than Essex, you've got to put in Lincoln, Rutland, Glanagwent, Carlisle, Allerdale, Copeland, Richmondshire, Craven, Lancaster, Barrow, Ribble, Pendle, Highburn, Blackburn, Rossendale, Rochdale, Knowsley, Redcar, Cleveland, Scarborough, Rydale and Selby. And you put them all together, And you create an area that's very similar to Hampshire, slightly bigger, so they could have voted more. And you find that 59% of them voted out, as opposed to 62%. And as opposed to Essex's 622,000 Leave voters, you've only got 611,000 in all those places that are currently said to have been the places that caused the result, which means we're going through the biggest educational process in this country's history for 200 years. We're learning about ourselves. Our officials have just broken up in Brussels, having tried to negotiate something where we don't have very much to offer, and they're trying to not to be condescending to us. We'll talk about it more. It is absolutely fascinating. Is anybody old enough to remember the Suez crisis? Great. People. Okay. I think Brexit is Suez times 10. Suez was our attempt to intervene in the canal and stop Egypt having control of it, because it's our canal. Turns out it wasn't our canal. The Americans told us to go home. It was all a bit embarrassing. It's a very short version of Suez, 1950s. The great thing about the Suez crisis, if you're worrying about what's going to happen next, is that it was very bad at the time. It felt very embarrassing and so on. But the people of Britain concluded that the people in charge of them were idiots and decided to elect a different set of people in the 1960s. And then we got really good music as well. And we got a society which changed in the 1960s. What happens in future doesn't necessarily have to be bad. When the people in power do something that might be very silly, that is, tell the population you've got a choice, you can stay or go, and then discover we can't go. One result of that after a few years' time is you accelerate social change and things can get better. Map 3 of the 7 maps, we'll speed up. People were told it was all about immigration. They try and say it wasn't now, it's about sovereignty, but boy, it was all about immigration. If you look at every election since 1997, immigration was the most salient political issue in voters' minds. People are told everything is wrong because of the immigrants, your schools are full and no good because of the immigrants, you can't get a house because of the immigrants, you can't get a nice job because of the immigrants. Everything's wrong because of the immigrants. We've got a set of newspapers who are telling people this. It was only the biggest economic crash since 1929 that knocked immigration into second place in the 2010 election, but it was still the second most important issue. The problem was everything was bad because of the immigrants. This is what people were told again and again for decade after decade. This is a European map of immigration. Again, the map is stretched. It stops you looking at mountains. Mountains are lovely. If you like physical geography, that's fine. It's just there's nobody on them. And if you draw a map like this on a normal, if you draw a distribution like this on a normal map, you get the completely wrong idea of what's going on because your eye looks at really remote settlements in rural areas and it's just useless. The dark blue areas here are areas where a fifth or slightly more than a fifth of the population were born in another country. So down here near me, you've got Spain, and the big blob in the middle of Spain is Madrid. And in general, you have a higher proportion of the population travelling further in capital cities like Madrid. And travelling further can include travelling over a national boundary. Now, it isn't just the young who travel further. Near to Madrid, on the coast of the Mediterranean, you'll see a very dark blue. And that's the Costa del Sol. And that's a part of Spain that's absolutely packed with immigrants. They don't call themselves immigrants, they call themselves expats. And you're going to meet some of them soon, because if they fall ill after the 29th of March, they've got to come home. But luckily, you've got lots of hospitals in Manchester. If they stay healthy, they can stay out there. It's going to be wonderful. And there's, as you see, I must get off Brexit, honestly. And it's geography. If you were trying, you know, I'll just say one thing. People always used to say about the former Chancellor of Exchequer, George Osborne, MP for a constituency near here, Tatton. that George had a secret plan. He was trying to make things really, really bad so he'd get a revolution. Turns out the person with the secret plan was David Cameron. Because if you were really trying to stir up trouble ahead, this is the way to do it. Anyway, back to the point. What's the point of this map? You'll see there's lots of yellow. The yellow are places where less than 5% of people are immigrants. They're generally places where there aren't many opportunities and you wouldn't want to go. Whenever there's opportunities, people turn up. That's what human beings do. We move around, we turn up. You only get a high rate of immigration if there's something to do when you turn up. Otherwise, people quickly leave again. Right? That's the nature of immigration. A lot of Eastern Europe is yellow. Even though people come from Russia and farther to the east, they don't come in that many numbers because it's lots of farms. It's not that exciting to be there. You've got a few other parts. Rural France is quite low. Portugal's quite low for immigration. But if you look, most of the north of England, apart from the light green we've got in Manchester, which is 5 to 10%, most of the north and west of England is in the lowest category for immigration in Europe. We haven't had that many immigrants. And those immigrants we've had have mainly gone to London. And who voted most strongly to remain? It's people in London. Like the second highest correlation of leave voting is the fewer immigrants you had in your area, the more likely you have to vote to leave. And the irony was that the reason people gave was it's the immigrants. It's not the highest. The highest correlation, just slightly higher, is with obesity. Right. I used to be thin, but I put on weight so I can make this point and not be being derogatory. Correlation of 0.8, really high, between a leave vote and obesity. Now it's not, I can tell you this because I put on weight, it's not because people who are a bit larger are a bit feckless and don't know what they're doing. Well, I can tell you that, you have to believe me because you know you're young and thin. It's because you're young and thin. This is a key. The best correlation with obesity in Britain is immigration. The immigrants are really annoying. They were young. Somebody else paid for their education. Well-educated. Thin. Fit. Healthy. And when you have a lot of people come over from another country who are like that, that's immigrants in general. There's a thing called the healthy immigrant effect. When you get a lot of people come over who are thin to certain areas, what happens to the population in the areas? They go, oh, I'm feeling a bit fat, I'm going to eat less. And it's actually an effect of immigration. People in cities with higher rates of immigration are thinner themselves. But if nobody turns up in your village for years and years and years, you can slowly eat a few more crisps and nobody notices. Okay? I'm putting it very, very crudely. It's called the obesogenic effect and the epidemiology and the epidemic of obesogenity. It's not just made up. The blob in the middle, in case you're wondering, is Switzerland. Switzerland is a long, thin country, lots of borders, higher immigration. Ireland, of course, is fascinating. And it's not just people who've come into Ireland from the European mainland, it's people who were born one or other side of the border, that border that doesn't exist anymore, as we are finding out. Map 4, number 7 maps, so this will end. Get out of Europe. Although we're obsessed by ourselves, we're obsessed by this country, we're obsessed by England, we kind of forget about the other parts of the UK, we're not that important. And we're increasingly less and less important. We were very, very important. We changed the entire population of the planet. You go back to when... How many of you have been to the Industrial Museum in Manchester? In the warehouse? Yeah. Was it a bit boring because you were too young? Or we've been good because your teacher's here. You're really lucky. That's the very first. You've got some of the very first warehouses. Lots of warehouses. You had some of the first cholera. Because those warehouses had to have goods and the goods came and the goods brought cholera. The reason for pointing this out... Just for the history, this little scrap of land on the northwest of Europe happened, mainly by chance, to be the place where it all kicked off. And by all kicking off, what I mean is, it's the place where people discovered that if you move goods around the world and control that movement of goods and make sure people have to buy your goods, you can make an enormous amount of money. So what they made here, many, many things, but above all else, it was cotton goods. The cotton came from America. It's picked in America. Came over to sea from America, comes to Manchester, is put together as garments in Manchester, and is then sent over the world, but principally to places like India, where we made sure that people in India couldn't make their own garments, so they had to buy our cotton. That's the point of having an empire. When we did that kind of thing, we disrupted the society of India. India then has a population boom. We also disrupted society in Africa because the cotton wasn't picked by people who actually came from Europe. It's picked by people that we stole from Africa and moved over to the Americas. We, and principally, you know, the sort of heart of the centre of this is around Manchester and Liverpool. We managed to disrupt more stable systems than any other country in the history of the world. The population of the planet went from 1 billion in 1820 to 7.5 billion today. And above all else, we were more responsible for that than anywhere else. Not our fault. If it hadn't been us, somebody else would have done it. But we're going to be discovering more. The world's changing. That kind of world is diminishing and going away. What you're seeing here is a map of the planet in which everywhere has been made proportional to the number of people. So you can see the size of Africa. You can see the size of Nigeria within Africa, if you're good at imagining. You can see the size of India. On it, you've got the sea routes, submarine cables. You can see the size of China, and you can see the lights of Tokyo in Japan. You're probably thinking, how can I tell where Tokyo and Japan is? But I've been looking at these maps for 20 years. You get used to it. And what you're looking there is the route of what was the world's largest ship about 2 years ago. And it sets off from the port of Dalian in China, and it travels all the way around. It takes about just over a month, and it ends up unloading its cargo in Rotterdam. And the cargo is unloaded in 20-foot metal containers, and those 20-foot metal containers put onto lorries, some onto railway, mainly onto lorries. And if the lorries went end-to-end, it would be 100 kilometres long. That's just one ship. So I'm trying to give you an idea of the kind of movement of goods around the planet. Notice it goes to Rotterdam, because you wouldn't dock in the UK if you had that many containers, because that isn't the large market. So that's one way of looking at the world. Map 5, let's look at the world a different way. Let's just take out the oceans. And you're seeing things differently again. Exactly the same technique. The areas are exactly the same size. They've changed in their orientation and shape somewhat. But you've got a very different picture in front of you. The traditional map of the world that you see, well, the original one was one called the Mercator projection. That was what I had when I first went to school. And the Mercator projection kept compass lines as straight lines. So it was quite useful if you were trying to sail a ship across an ocean. Because you draw a straight line on the map, you follow the compass, that's where you're going to get. A bit later, you get the Peters projection. And the Peters projection was an equal land area projection. It made Africa much bigger. It was voted in at the UN, mainly because the Caribbean islands all get a vote, and it makes the Caribbean islands look bigger. And it was a much fairer map than the Mercator projection. The Mercator projection made Russia look enormous, which in the Cold War, which luckily most of you haven't had to experience, I think very few of you went to bed at night thinking, will I wake up in the morning because the missiles are about to go off? We used to worry about that. In the Cold War, the Mercator projection was partly popular because it made Russia look really, really big. But the one that we showed you, or your parents, had the UK bang in the centre. And not just bang in the centre, it's bang in the centre and up about two-thirds. Now, if you ever see a map, the focal point that people look at with their eyes is bang in the centre and up two-thirds. And the reason that's where you look at is that that's where people's eyes are in their face. And you are programmed to look at people's faces. It's just what it's about being human. I'm now worrying that you're not looking at the map and you're looking at me because I get self-aware. We're the only ape who has white around our eyes, which means that you can actually tell if people are paying attention to you. I won't go into all the theories of this, they're fascinating. But essentially, we are acutely aware of what other people think of us. We worry about what they think of us. It preoccupies us. Nobody is so egotistical and narcissistic that they're not worried about what their peers think of them. It's an evolutionary thing. It's what kept human beings alive when we lived in small bands. Because essentially, if people don't like you, they leave you on your own, that's it, you're going to die. The bad news is that we're left with the worry. And hence, you may worry at school about, do they like me or not? And that's just some fade in your genes. But that same kind of thinking relates to how maps are drawn and how people think about maps because of looking at that point. So when you look at this map and you look in the middle and you look two-thirds up, what you see is India. Because what you're seeing on this map is the actual centre of population of the world, which is now in India. It's a little bit further down. The map was drawn by Ben Hennig, who's a brilliant cartographer now based in Iceland. He drew it for Carl Lee and me when we're doing a book. And Carl Lee proposed that we buy a piece of land at the centre of the world. And we almost did, because it was very cheap in a village in India. And then we suddenly realised that, of course, it moves. And so we'd be left with this field, which wouldn't be very useful. But look at that map. If you've got good eyesight in China, you can see Chongqing. Right? That's the world's largest city, Chongqing, which I've still got to learn how to pronounce properly. 30 million people work with paddy fields in it. People are always arguing about how do you define a city, what's the largest city, and so on. On these kind of maps, I wish I hadn't brought you the one of China. China is a sea of cities. On these maps, you get some idea of where the cities are. That's the shape of the planet now from the point of view of people. The United States is a relatively unimportant area sloping off to the edge. It farms grain, which is exported mainly to China. And in China, they make things that are complicated, which at the moment they send back to America. They're not going to do that forever. Europe, up at the top, was in the centre of the world politically. It is shrinking in all kinds of ways at the moment. Interestingly, we're choosing to shrink faster than the rest of it. So I think we're either fifth or sixth largest economy in the world right now. But I can tell you, because we know what's happened to the pound versus the dollar, that next year we'll be down to the sixth, and the year after that we're down to the seventh, and that's already banked. This is going to come to a shock to people. So we're getting economically smaller in a continent that's getting economically smaller, but was only ever economically so big because it exploited people in the rest of the planet. We didn't tell ourselves that story. We told us a story that said that we produced the most amazing spinning jennies. And we created a special locomotive which allowed you to pump water out of mines. Because that's a much nicer story to tell yourselves than we started the biggest slave trade and we forced people to buy our goods. As you said, I went to New Zealand for a few months amongst my sort of not getting out of Britain travels. And one of the most interesting things about going to New Zealand is going to a supermarket and trying to buy some linen. And they don't have a word for linen in a supermarket in New Zealand. The word for linen that's put above the aisle is Manchester. Right? That's what they still call it, Manchester. We're on the edge. Let's go forward. Just two more maps. So this map now looks a bit more normal to you, because that map was really weird. So we've just gone back to a population cartogram, and it's an easier map. To see in an easier map to understand. And you've seen this map before. You've seen this on a normal projection. It's called the sky at night map. And you're all aware of that. But when you see that map on a normal projection, what you think you're seeing is a map of where people live. But you're not. You're seeing a map of light pollution. That's what this map is. The map is a map of people who've got so much spare money and so little common sense that they're willing to shine light up into the sky so that a satellite can capture it and produce this image. Now on this projection, this equal population projection, every area has exactly the same population density. Same number of people in every little square millimetre. If you want to get really nerdy about it, the lines of latitude and the lines of longitude still meet at 90 degrees. They're just curved. So I did maths at university as well as geography. That's weird. You can actually use this map to drive across continents if you wanted. Every area has got equal population density. So there are exactly the same number of people in every tiny spot on the map. So it's no longer telling you where people are. Because people are everywhere and at the same density. So an area is darker for two possible reasons. One is that the people don't have much electricity or much money to spend on the electricity. And the other possibility is they've worked out not to shine the light up into the sky. Now, we don't know which one of it is in different areas, but electricity is spreading, has spread right around the world. So this is a map of profligate waste. It's a very different way of seeing exactly the same data projected in a different way. This is one of the most modern versions of the map. And so, interestingly, Cairo, up at the top end of the Nile, is one of the brightest areas at the moment. The area that was brightest about 5 years before was Tokyo. But they had a tsunami off the sea in Japan. And it wrecked a nuclear power plant. And when it wrecked the nuclear power plant, they decided to turn all the nuclear power plants off, which was a quarter of their electricity generation. And the lights dimmed in Tokyo because the cost of electricity went up. And they decided they didn't need to shine as much in the sky anymore. You could tell story after story with different maps, of different ways of seeing the world. My last slide. So please think of a question. A silly one of the universe. That's the universe. Okay, this is the periodic table. And there is a very obsessive chemistry lecturer at the University of Sheffield who's taken the periodic table and produced all different kinds of cartograms of it by weight of atomic element or whatever. The top one there is the universe. It's mostly hydrogen and helium, so you can't see the rest. The lower one is the Earth's surface. So different ways of looking at things. But the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is that weird shape over there. Because this is a map which doesn't exist. This is a map that one of you may draw. And you could be the first person ever to draw it. I've just shown you two-dimensional cartograms. You can imagine producing a two-dimensional cartogram of Manchester. You'd be pushing the middle out a bit, particularly where they've got all these students to flood into this student accommodation, where you have to give them more space because you want to see them all. The suburbs on the edge of Manchester would probably stay roughly the same. The fields beyond them would all be brought in because there's nobody there. And you'd have a map of Manchester and Greater Manchester and the rest of the northwest, which have an even population density. The next thing I want you to do is to go above in your mind, because I haven't got this because I can't show it you. Somebody proved this was possible mathematically in 1976. You take your two-dimensional cartogram, and then you take it off the surface, and you make it three-dimensional. And you pull at the middle of Manchester to begin with. And what you're doing is you're making distance on the surface proportional to the amount of time it takes you to travel. So you're going to create a map of Manchester that shows what the speed of traffic is. And in the morning, it looks like a mountain because it's hard to get in. But it's a mountain which will have holes going through it because that's the trains. Because it doesn't matter for the trains whether it's the morning or not. And it might be the trams if somebody's worked it out properly. So you've got a mountain with holes going through. And then tied off the top, you've got these strings, rather like tight ropes. And that's the planes going from the airports. And if you, in your mind, try and extend this map to the whole planet, you've actually turned the planet inside out, and the tight ropes are on the inside, because the fastest way to get from one side of the world to the other is to fly. And to make the length proportional to how long it takes, it has to be a line that goes through the middle of the Earth. And I'm hoping I've lost everybody at this point. Okay? But these are the kind of things we can get to think about doing at university. Nobody's done it. They proved it was possible mathematically in 1976. So it's really annoying. You know it's possible to do it. You might be thinking, why would you want to do this? It's a map that tells you how your city works. This three-dimensional map, which is a mountain that's hard to get in the morning, with a ring road that's kind of tight and fast around the outside. And then you can animate your 3D map throughout the day. And you can watch the mountain come down as it gets easier to go into. And then you can watch it invert as it becomes harder to get out, as people are trying to commute out. And it goes up and it goes down, and it looks like it's breathing. We have animations of the planet, where we make every square cell of latitude and longitude proportional to the amount of water falling every month. And you can Google these. And if you Google animation of the monsoon moves around the planet, you'll see the planet Earth appearing to have a heartbeat in the way that the map changes over time. But I'm not confident enough to try and make that happen on a computer, so I don't do that. All these things are going to happen. Most of the maps I've shown you didn't exist when I was at school. Most of the maps that we have now will not be used in 30 years' time. We're going to be looking at the world in a completely different way, but we'll also be in a completely different world. The big, big mistake is to think that things are going to be just as they are. Things are changing very, very quickly in terms of what we understand about ourselves and how we see the planet and how we see other people. Thank you ever so much for your attention. Thank you.
Okay, guys, we have about 5 to 10 minutes for questions, so we have any questions.
Yes, you showed the interesting map about the Brexit vote. Have you any analysis of how the Brexit vote and produced a map on it on age, different age categories? Because I have seen Brexit dubbed by the old, of the old, for the old. Is there any truth in that?
By age, the older you are on average, the higher it goes up. It's by the old and of the old, but it's not for the old. So the elderly people who are voting Brexit, this is over 65, over 75, when you asked them, said they were voting for their grandchildren. So they had a chance of getting a house and so on. Age is the biggest determinant of voting Brexit. If you want a reason for it, my friend Sally Tomlinson and I have written a book, which will come out in January. Sally studies textbooks. She studies geography textbooks. And she's gone over them over the last 100 years. When I was at school, I was taught resource geography, where you get copper and tin and rubber from and how you get it off people. The reason geography is about rivers and mountains and people is it's a subject designed to produce colonial officers to run an empire. We had to change the subject after the last colony went. Luckily, climate change came along and we had a purpose again. Otherwise, you wouldn't have geography in universities without climate change. The reason I'm saying this about the vote of the elderly is that when you look at geography textbooks in the past, people were taught that they were superior, that Britain was great because it should be great. When I first went to France at age 15 on a school trip, I got 10 francs for the pound. That's like 10 euros for every pound I had. I was a king. I was a schoolboy. I could buy bottles of wine for nothing. If you went to France and flew via Gatwick this year, you had to pay £1.11 for a euro. So my take on it is that by age on average, people have just watched this country fall apart and they think something's gone very badly wrong and we should be great. What nobody ever told them in their geography textbooks 70 years ago, 60, 50 years ago, is that the reason we were rich is because we were exploiting other people. We were never taught that. You're taught a little bit of it now. Geography is getting better, but really not enough of it. And the reason it matters is we are now economically the most unequal country in Europe. We're very weird. why are we the most economically unequal country in Europe? What's different about us, the rest of Europe? And I think the strongest thing you can find is that we have the world's biggest empire. And as you lose it, we became relatively poorer. And what we did as the colonies went, as India went and the African colonies went in the 60s and 70s, is the people with money kept their money, and so people without money had to lose and go down. And we abandoned the north, and we abandoned people who had working jobs. And inequalities divided for 30 years. And it got worse and worse and worse. And what do you do? How do you tell the population that this is happening? You need to find something to blame. You can't say, well, we want to hold on to our money, and you're not going to have any. You tell the population, oh, it's the immigrants. That's the reason why you've got less. Whereas it wasn't the reason. I promise the next answer will be really short. Go on. Yes?
It might surprise people outside this room, but people outside this room can't read maps. Yeah. It surprises me that people can't read maps. And what you're doing here is making more complicated maps.
Yeah.
So in trying to communicate some of the messages you're trying to do, you do need that basic comprehension of maps. You got any advice on how we can educate people outside this room and how to read
how
maps?
To do it. Yeah. What will shock you is taxi drivers normally can't use a map. Don't actually need to. And this is a day for sat nav. Ability to use graphics is changing by the generations. So if you are under 25, you've spent your whole life with screens. You're used to things moving. You're used to the idea of pictures. The older people are, the less able they are to use images and pictures, particularly ones that move. Maybe I'm getting old. I tried to get my granddad once to use the internet at all. And he just wouldn't. I don't know. Have any of you got great-grandparents or grandparents who were never online? A few of you? Yeah. Okay, so this is my hope. It's changing. What you're seeing here in terms of a map is the equivalent of log paper in terms of a graph. Now, log paper is a complicated idea. But on a log graph, you draw a straight line, it tells you acceleration. It's very useful. Most people in Britain can't cope with actually a normal graph, let alone a log scale graph. But they're getting better. There's a thing called the Flynn effect, and it's worth looking up. If you want to be smug and you're young, F-L-Y-N-N, the Flynn effect. The Flynn effect is about how every generation is cleverer than the one before them. Has a higher IQ when we measure IQ. So you're getting cleverer and cleverer and cleverer. Part of it's actually better teachers. A couple of my teachers were good, but I was also taught by men demobbed from the war who had just been given a job and couldn't teach. You know, your teachers are qualified, they've been to university, a bit more interested. Part of it's that. But it's also, as the world changes, it's easier to be cleverer. And before you get too smug about the Flynn effect and tell your grandparents how thick they are on average, because it really annoys them, because they like to say standards have fallen, and it's the opposite. Older generations know how to do things like dig up potatoes or skin a rabbit, which you don't generally know how to do. So we've transplanted one form of knowledge for another. But I agree. I mean, most people looking at this would ask me, what am I on? You know. These maps are much better, by the way, if you are not sober. Do you want to do one last one? Anybody under? Great. I think you are under what I was going to say. You're under my age by far. You're a different generation. Go on.
And we know map skills are really, really essential for our students, but you're saying that maps in 20, 30 years' time will be different. Are the important map skills that we should be attempting to teach our students for the future? Do you have any suggestions?
For doing it. Yeah. Try and teach. Just spend 5 minutes going beyond what you have to teach for the 6-point GCSE question or the 9-point A-level question. Just 5 minutes. I know you mainly have to teach for that. So the kind of skills are, how many of you walked to this campus and looked at one of the campus maps on your way? You know, the ones directing you? Okay. Now, they made a mistake, which on other campuses they haven't. So the modern way of doing those maps is you orientate them. So always, when you're looking at that map on the pavement, always ahead of you is straight on. And the north arrow is at a funny angle. Whoever did the ones for this campus has decided that either north is always north, or it's that way, which is why you found it hard to get here. So it's understanding street art maps, that kind of thing, and also why they use so much yellow. I mean, you know, if you go into London and you walk in on the pavement and you're looking at the how do I get here maps, loads of yellow. So that kind of modern map. The difference between a map you might use to go for a walk, which is a very rare thing to do, and a map you might look at to look at social inequality. And given a huge amount of data, what do you actually want to see? And the last thing I do is go back to an old map like Charles Booth's poverty maps, you know, the ones with black and red. The black was vicious, semi-criminal, poor, and the poshest were yellow. Go back to one of those very old maps from the 1890s and ask, why is nobody producing a map as good as that today? Because things don't always get better. Those very old maps were absolutely striking. But try and think ahead. You're constrained by the GCSE and A-level marking scheme, which I would fail an A-level now, because the answers I would write would not get the points that you need. I'd be very proud of my answers, you know, and I'd smugly think I was writing what was correct. I'll do it one day and see if I get a D or an E at A-level. Right? Your teachers are constrained by what you have to do to get the marks in our marking system. But that doesn't mean you can't just move a little bit beyond it and try and guess. And if you want, let's last one ask you, how many of you are not going to university? My son is not going to university. It's absolutely fine not to go. But are you brave enough to say? No. Okay, you all go to university then. Yeah. Don't worry if you're not going to save a lot of money if you don't. The minute you turn up at a university, if you do geography or almost any other subject, it is completely different. There is no national syllabus. There are no set exams. Every university department makes its own exams up every year. So suddenly, you're going to have to deal with weirder ideas. If you're unlucky enough to come to my university and get me, you suddenly get these, right? But you don't know where you're going to be, and you don't know who's going to be teaching you. So you're going to have to deal with strange ideas, and it's such a jump from this is what you need to get the 6 points on the 6-point question to we don't know what's going to be in the exam and it's all very strange. Okay, so I think with teachers, if the majority of your students are heading off to university, help prepare them for that so the shock isn't so bad. The great news about university is that everybody passes. Okay, almost everybody passes who works. It's very, very different from A-level. You have to really, really try quite hard or be very unlucky not to pass. Thank you very much.